So how do you want to start? You want me to say like topics, or you want me to just let Saya take over and start?
No, Saya's not taking over.
That means Saya clean.
I want to hear Saya take over and say, like, this is my show now, and we're going to go through these topics.
And you are going to listen to me, damn it.
I know. Can you do that, please?
I think I just did. Actually.
Yes, mommy.
We're talking about Etsy and Pinterest all night long.
All right. So I'll give like a pause, and I'll say, welcome back to another beautiful episode of Elevated. And, you know, I'll say something like, all my ruddy friends are here tonight.
Let's do it.
And then Say is going to come in, and she's just going to take over. And then Say is going
to
say,
"He's not, though. I don't know where you guys are getting this idea."
Way to put her on the spot.
Listen, Mama Bear, you have to be, you're the one with the topics, right?
I don't know. Ask Bossman over there. He's running a sweatshop.
Oh, boy. Holy crap.
Hey, I just threw out some suggestions the other day. That's all. Right.
All right, so I'll start the show, and then and then we'll go through. You know, I'll do it. I'll be proper. Well, I'll behave myself.
Is Dana being included?
That's up to you guys, because
that's up to her. I mean, are we mentioning that she is sitting on your lap or not?
Whoa!
I don't want to be proper. I think this should be raw and edgy, man. I'm tired of this fucking woozy. Like, really, let's shock some people. You know, Joe Rogan's podcast. Joe Rogan's podcast isn't the number one podcast in the world because he's trim and proper about everything he talks about.
Let's do it then.
Ruffle some fucking feathers.
Let's do it then. I'll start with this. I'll start.
Oh boy.
All right. So I'll give it like 5 seconds, and I'll introduce everyone.
Let me take a deep breath, please, before we get raw and edgy here. I'm sweating over here.
How's about this? Christmas round table.
Okay.
Right.
Good.
What?
Jim, Saya, Dana, and Steve.
Sounds good.
I'll just put Christmas episode up.
Let's just do holiday round table. Yeah.
Holiday. We don't say Christmas.
Oh yeah.
I do.
All right. In 3, 2, welcome back to another less bougie episode of Elevated with a lot of cursing. Is that good? How's that? A lot of fucking and shit and all that good stuff.
Is this the actual fucking interlude, or is this a trial run?
We're doing the fucking show right now. This is the holiday special in the spirit of our Lord. And I have a wonderful lineup. I have Mr. Jim Hernandez. Say hello.
Hello, hello.
And Miss Saya.
Hi.
And Miss Dana.
Hello.
And I am your ever gracious host, Steve Matthews. We have a little something special today.
Well, first of all, I'm in Los Angeles. Saya's in Denver. Where are you two?
We're in the great state of New Jersey. Yeah.
Do you happen to be
the only state that matters?
Do you happen to be in the same house in the great state of New Jersey?
We're in the same vicinity.
Like on the same couch, or
no? I'm actually running back and forth between the two houses.
Okay.
And yeah, hold on. Let me catch my breath.
Hey,
okay,
Steve, how's that rigorous honesty going there?
is this the same Dana that was on the Zoom with you? Is this like Zoom official now? Is this now Zoom and Elevated Podcast official? You know, back in the day when it was like you had to be Facebook official. I think this is like.
Yeah, could be, Jim.
I'll just, you know, let me just put it out.
I think we let Dana answer that. That sounds pretty good.
I'll just say this, all right? We had the same song on MySpace. That's all I'm saying. So when you go on a MySpace,
that's pretty big. That's pretty big.
Metallica. Yeah, Sanitarium, by the way.
You guys met in the Yahoo chat room?
Dana, we can take this offline and have more of a conversation.
Don't think, Steve, in your last post, don't think I didn't notice there was 3 steaks in that package you got.
Yeah.
I know you can eat a lot, but I don't think you can eat 3. So I can do the math. I'm not smart, but I can figure some shit out here.
Yeah.
You might not be a smart guy, but you
Duke
know
was one of them. Duke got one of the steaks, my dog.
Nice. Raw. It's good to be back, you guys. It's good to be back. We had a fun episode last time.
This is the more edgy elevated episode. They're going to get a little edgier, if that's possible.
You know, it's about time. These bougie, trim and proper stuff. Like, come on, we're fucking addicts in recovery.
No kidding. I mean, we're all fighting the demons. So, I mean, it just gets better, you know.
I'm just glad we're not on video because I think my cheeks are a nice shade of fuchsia right now.
Are they real?
Why is that?
You got a goody two shoes in the gym.
Oh, you got it. That's totally me.
I like that picture of Colorado. It makes me want to go out to the Rockies right now. Instead of sitting here in Jersey. But we did get a foot of snow up here, so.
Is that where you're from, Zilla?
I live in Colorado. I'm from Chicago.
Gotcha. Okay.
We couldn't tell with that accent.
What, Chicago?
Yeah.
Is that funny, Tim? It is.
Coming from the girl with the Etsy account and Poshmark, and she's probably wearing a dress right now from the suburbs.
Oh my God.
With the cute necklace.
Uh-huh.
Are you talking about me or her?
Who knows what Dana's having you do, buddy? Oh,
with a necklace?
It involves Christmas ornament.
Some of those necklaces Sans wears, they can double for something else, probably.
Okay, so let's get back to the topic.
This is going to be Saya's show from now on, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Saya's got the topics. Number one. Go ahead,
Jim. You wanted to kick it off.
No, I didn't.
Someone's got to kick it off. Okay, well,
told me
this?
To remind you because you have dementia. So go ahead.
let's bring it back to the host of this wonderful program. We're going to talk about... you want to talk about dating in early sobriety or you want to talk about marijuana maintenance?
Both.
Which one first?
Well, you're next to your new girlfriend. Let's talk about dating in early sobriety.
Well, if I was in... Yeah, I feel like I'm in early sobriety. So, I did a cardinal mistake when I was in recovery early on. Like 5 months in, I moved in with a girl. Okay, Jim, you go. You're up.
Oh shit!
That was not a.
Oh, that was a hard cut. That was a hard cutout. You know
what happened?
That was just a little fun fact. There was nothing substantial behind that.
I'm throwing that out and I'm bailing.
That was like hot potato, man. You just tossed it to the next person.
Yeah,
that was so edgy.
I just started a fire, and you can put it out. Here you go. So I moved in with a young lass, and I was all rip roaring and ready to go, and I thought that it would be a good idea to move in with someone. And I guess you could say I was in lust, but that wore off pretty quick. And it just wasn't meant to be, you know. I pretty much ruined that, you know. I could take that one. I'll take that one.
Maybe what you're saying is like it worked out better for Dana.
It worked out better for Dana. It, you know what? And I stayed sober.
Right.
Which was the most important thing to me.
Now, Steve, can I ask you, was she in recovery?
No, she wasn't. No, she was a normal person who, like, I think she had like one glass of wine, and I felt bad because, you know, it's like one of those things. It's my fault that it ended. Let's put it that way. It wasn't going to work, but I ended it. You know, I gave it a year. You know, I lived.
Did you have a sponsor?
But I'm sorry.
Did you have a sponsor at that time?
Yeah, and I wound up getting parting ways with him after I had about 3 months into the relationship, and then I got my sponsor I had for like the last 11 years. It was a bad idea from the start, and it just goes to show you that even in sobriety, when you try and do something right, you can still hurt people. You know, you can still... I don't know to what degree I did hurt this person, but it definitely... fell apart, you know, and it was primarily my fault. So it was hard to take because now you have to overcome that, like the fear of like messing something up like that, you know, getting into something in early sobriety, knowing better. And then on top of that, I had to turn around and come to grips with the fact that, yeah, I probably ended a relationship, you know, that probably would have been okay had I not been such a head case at the time.
You know, good.
I was just going to say, did your sponsor weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, but the new one did. And he said, listen, if I was, your sponsor at that time, this never would happen, you know. And to some degree, I'm like, well, I'll do what I want to do. But then, you know, he was right. Probably he would advise against it at least, and perhaps even let me go as a sponsee had I, you know, disregarded not a direct order, but a one that I knew better.
Mm-hmm.
And despite all of that, I stayed sober. And it, you like, everything happens for a reason. I moved on, and it was better, you know, better off that way for both parties.
I think our listeners are going to love this because, you know, I think with everybody's a different spot in their lives when they get into recovery. Like, a lot of people are married, and then when they get sober, whether you get sober with your spouse or you get sober and your spouse doesn't, you know, a lot of us are. I was single when I got sober. So my early recovery, you know, but there's so many different variables out there, and people are going to relate to so many different situations. Like for me, I got sober. I was single. I was a fucking disaster. There's no way I could have been with anybody. But, you know, everybody, they say, don't date for a year. And I think everybody that I know in early recovery that when they got sober, they were single. I think we all just said, fuck it, you know, oh, we'll be fine. Or, you know, just it's natural for us to want to be with somebody and have that companionship. And so you're going through all these changes. And you know, of course, I got sober in a fucking transitional rehab facility with, you know, guys straight out of prison and off the streets of being homeless, which I was homeless before I, you know, found this government funded program. So I'm in a facility for 7 months where I lived there. In the first 30 days, you can't even go out. But my dumbass decides to, you know, when you finally get a cell phone, to start a Match.com account or Plenty of Fish. I live in a fucking rehab facility where I can't even leave. But for 2 hours on Tuesday and Thursday, but I think I'm like prime material for some broad out in Los Angeles. You know? How fucking stupid
That's
is that?
Really interesting.
Wow. Right?
How'd that work out, Jim?
Oh my God. I mean, come on. Women go for guys in prison. So what's wrong with the guy that can actually leave for 2 hours Tuesdays and Thursdays?
Yep,
so.
The more screwed up you are, the more you can, your the ability for change.
Seriously. But no, in all seriousness though, like, all my counselors and everything, and everybody I know, and if you have a sponsor, they tell you don't date for a year in early sobriety. And, you know, my first relapse was, I got to 11 months sober, and my first relapse was because of a woman, because of, you know, there was probably multiple things, you know, not going to lie, like insecurity of performing sexually, not under the influence, is a huge one, I think, for a lot of us. Like, because we had only, you know, got most of our sexual encounters were high or drunk or both. So, but, you know, in retrospect, in hindsight, you know, I did everything I shouldn't have done. And I just realized why you're not supposed to, because A, if you start dating, first of all, you're in no mental shape. You don't even know who the fuck you are. You're changing. You have nothing to, I didn't have anything emotionally or financially, anything to offer anybody. But I think one of the big things that I don't think is talked about enough is, if you're in early sobriety and you're doing good, but then you start dating somebody and say that relationship ends, are you emotionally stable enough to be able to handle that? Or is that going to set you into a relapse? Which I think is a big thing that people don't really think about, that aspect of it. Like, if you get involved with somebody, you, first of all, you haven't really healed and figured out who you are as an individual yet and started to love yourself as yourself and not part of a couple or whatever it is. You know, you really have to love yourself before you can love anybody else. And you're not stable enough early on to be able to handle rejection if you do get rejected. So, you know, that was a big thing with me as well. You know, I started dating somebody and then things went bad and I wasn't emotionally ready for it. I've relapsed 8 times. So, and I think they all had to do with women. So I think I can tell you what not to do.
Yeah, I think the whole reason why you're not supposed to date in the first year is because of your instability as an alcoholic or a drug addict in recovery. And I think with me, it was with, like anyone else, it was the emotional strain that it puts on you, because I think that you don't have time to look at yourself if you're in a relationship. You know, if you're in a relationship with someone and you're focused, like, almost like a drug or the alcohol would take the focus off reality. You're focused on someone else. You probably don't have enough left in you to do like a proper fourth step, you know, and that's where people go out anyway. So
that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say, I think, first of all, I think the reason that they tell you a year, I mean, I think a year, you're really, me personally, I had time to actually completely detox my body and start detoxing my brain and really uncovering, I think, who I really was. Like Jim just said, learning who you really are without all of that stuff, whether it's in a relationship with someone else or in your own head. And for me, I...
You were married, right? Say, you were married when you first got sober, correct?
The divorce was filed 2 weeks into sobriety. So within my first 6 months, I went through the divorce. I went through parental responsibilities evaluator, substance abuse evaluator to see if my kids were going to go back to Illinois or if they were going to stay here. See if I would even have custody of them. I ended up getting 90% custody time. So that spoke volumes anyway. But I also got into a relationship about 5 months sober with someone who I didn't know at when I first met this person until really the initial conversation. When the person asked me, do you want to go get coffee? I'm like, what is wrong with them? Who asks if they want to get coffee? So obviously he was in recovery. But I think I honestly went through that whole list that they tell you not to go through. And I think I just checked everything off as I went. I started back to school. I started a new job. I moved, moved my kids in with this guy. Just a lot of life stuff really quickly. And this is all only 8 months after living in Colorado. So for me, I think I didn't want to hear, I knew better. I didn't want to hear what any woman, or especially my sponsor, I didn't want to hear what she had to say. And now when I talk with women, I'm like, don't look at him. Don't talk to him. You don't have a phone. Do not give him your number. But he's really nice. I'm like, yeah, just don't. He'll be really nice in a year. So I think it's interesting because there's a reason that these people knew what they knew and I didn't. And I just, I don't know. Hindsight clearly is 2020. Do I wish I had listened? Yeah. But did I also learn a lot? Yeah. So I don't know.
It definitely, it's easier to look, you know, it's easier like said than done, like they say. It's easier for me to say to some newcomer, like, don't do this, don't do that. And then some people, like myself, are the type of person that needs to experience doing something, even if it's a tremendous mistake, before I learn my lesson. And it's hard being a sponsor and telling someone, especially someone of our mental capacity, not to do something when our whole lives really revolved around doing shit that we knew we shouldn't be doing, you know?
Especially stuff that we did ourselves.
Oh, okay. Right.
Like, we all dated within 6 of the year. So it's so funny that, I mean, it's like that 13-year-old kid that he's going to learn something later, or he should listen to you. I don't even know what I'm doing with that. But we all did it, even though we were told not to. And then now we're trying to tell other people not to.
Right. And again, coming from exactly where, for me, coming from where my sponsor was coming from, she said the same thing. I've been there. Don't do it. Please don't do it. I'm like, yeah, right. You haven't been where I've been, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sure as shit, I should have listened immediately, but. I think the hardest part for me, one of the hardest parts with that relationship in particular was that people began to know the two of us in meetings, and it was almost now there's a cordialness, but it was almost awkward, you know. So I think I didn't think about that part, you know. It was like this fairy tale happy ever after was going to come, and it was all just in my brain, you know.
It's you know, like you were saying before, I thought that I was different when I came in, and that goes for every aspect of my life, how I viewed people, how I viewed myself, what I thought I could handle, you know, because there's a certain sense of power that I felt once I learned that I was this alcoholic minded person and I had given up my will. You know, my will kind of strengthened in another aspect where I thought that maybe I could, now I could do things with my life. I can go out and do what I really want to do, minus the drugs and alcohol. And it's like short-sightedness when now I have, like, you know, I don't have the short-sightedness as much, still to some degree, but not as bad, especially when it comes to stuff like that. And I try to, like, sit back and decipher the information that's being handed to me instead of just jumping on something emotionally, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I have, if I could just interject, I have a little bit of a different take, and I apologize if I'm getting off the topic here, but you know, I came into recovery. I was already in very involved in an 8-year relationship, and you know, that person that I was with helped me tremendously through my recovery. You know, just in as far as, you know, being completely supportive in so many different ways. And but ultimately, you know, I knew that it wasn't a healthy relationship for me to be in. And I think I carried that with me for several years after, you know, still being sober and just really not being able to break free of that situation because I was terrified to go back out there and have to date, you know, in a sober atmosphere, you know, without alcohol. You know, I had my first boyfriend when I was, you know, high school, and we dated for 5 years. And then shortly after that, I started going out and meeting people and drinking and all that kind of stuff that goes along with that. And I had continued that, well, you know, for the next 20 years. So, you know, I found myself in a situation where I was just like, oh gosh, now I got to get back out there. I gotta meet somebody. I gotta do it without being under the influence. Like, how is this gonna even happen for me? And I just was really terrified. And again, I apologize if I'm getting off topic.
No, but I think that's really a key point, is that's the whole that really encompasses the whole topic of dating in early recovery, I think, and dating in recovery at all. But
yeah.
It is terrifying. It's,
yeah. Regardless of age, you're like, what am I doing? Yeah. How did I get here again?
Yeah.
And so how do we have certain needs? Do we have certain needs that are animalistic, that are, like, you know, front and center when we get sober? And that's, like, let's be honest, it's physical at that point. It's like that overwhelming, barbaric physical attraction to have a member of whatever sex you prefer, you know, because your emotions are completely flooding into your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, I know.
Go ahead, Jim.
Wow.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, what's funny is, after I got out of rehab, my sponsor, when I was, so I was 7 months clean or sober. So my sponsor is like, do not fucking date. Don't do it. It's the worst thing ever. I'm like, but these, like, come on. Like, you know, I don't know if you guys heard of the Pink Cloud, but when I went through the Pink Cloud, man, and that was like 2-3 months sober, the only thing I can compare that to for myself was like ecstasy. And I would just, sometimes I would just lay in my bed and I would just have the stupidest big grin on my face, because I just felt like my, you know, the euphoric feeling of when I was on E, I felt that, but just naturally sober, because I was going through that Pink Cloud that many people talk about, and it shocks me that a lot of people have never heard of it or maybe experienced it. But so when I got out of rehab, my sponsor was like, all right, do not date. And I'm like, but man, I need to. And he was like, just go find a fuck buddy, to somebody that's mutually understanding, that you're just going to, you know, you guys are just going to hook up. It's just going to be sex. That's it. No feelings, no feelings. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't know if I'm capable of that. Like, but so what do you guys think about that? Like, have you heard, am I the only one that multiple people have told, just go find somebody, like, in early recovery, don't date within a year, but it's okay to go find somebody?
I think so.
It depends on the sponsor, I guess. I was with more older heads that were traditional and they didn't have views like that. They were more, you know, old 40 kind of people. I mean, they didn't discuss such things. It was just, if that's what you did, that's what you did. And if you told them afterwards, like many people would do, or if it happened to be a female and she had, you know, an older head, as you call them, a member of the Elder Scrolls of AA, those things weren't talked about until like after you did it, because I guess it's that whole like asking for forgiveness instead of permission.
Yeah.
Well, I got sober around a bunch of straight people, so it was just raw. And my sponsor was like, "We're all from the streets." You know, I got sober with a bunch of people that are straight out of prison or straight from being homeless. So our sponsors and my counselors in the facility were from the same thing. And so, you know, it was raw and it was real. And it was, they were just like, "All right, well, you got your needs. Like, just go handle that. Just don't date." And like, so it was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
it was understood almost.
Well, I think what I was going to say was, I think I don't know. It sounds like from that, what you just described, that they knew that you were going to do that anyway. And mm-hmm. they were just almost,
you're human.
Well,
you know?
But almost reminding you, like, hey, you barely know yourself. You barely know your own emotions.
Yeah.
Don't break someone's heart because you don't even know what your needs right now.
Yeah, and vice versa. Right. You get your heart broken too.
Or you relapse. Right. Something happens to you and it sets you off on a relapse. Like, Dana, like what you said, I was terrified. You know, when I first got sober, man, I was the most insecure person. Like, we're trying to figure things out. Our minds are... I overthought everything. Like, I overthought things. They're not going to like me. I'm not going to be smart. I'm not going to be funny.
Right.
You know, everything we've used alcohol for our whole lives, we took that one common denominator out of it. But all those insecurities, which is why we drank, those were still there. So don't dig within
you. Well, Jim, I know you said it kind of off the cuff, but I think it's really, for me, and, you know, I say this every time we talk, guys, but I can only talk about my experience, but what you just said at the beginning of this is exactly right. I didn't know how to behave in a relationship sober. I didn't when I would drink out at a bar when I was 17, it was for attention, and I was getting drinks, and so when I came into sobriety, I didn't know how to behave. I didn't know what that looked like. I questioned all motives coming at me because I had never experienced really pure motives. Like, what do you want from me? Instead of, oh, you're actually decent.
Right. Say, I can agree with that because I feel like, you know, and I'm apologize if I'm stepping on your toes, but I feel like for a large part of my drinking career, quote unquote, like I would do that. I would go out with guys and like you didn't have like a nice you know, soft kiss at the end of the night. It was just you went out with the good person, you got annihilated, you wondered how you got home the next day, and like that was like dating for me. And like, that is such a sick, twisted way to think. And like, you know, I didn't know how I would get back to a point of like just going on, like going out with a nice guy, like for
well
a nice
and what did that even look like?
Who was a
nice guy?
Yeah,
I think this is where men and women differ drastically, because when I got sober, it was almost like anything that walked, like I got a smile on my face. And I know it sounds like horrible, but I'm sure Jim understands. You know, that testosterone and that male ego just comes flooding back in. And it's like, oh boy. Men don't really run on emotions.
Really?
Historically, I'm saying. Like, that's not, you know.
Come on, Steve.
That was the whole point, where men are not emotional and women are emotional. That's the difference between men and women. And, you know, I think it's really a reality, and more so in early sobriety, because men just, it seems like guys just have one thing on their minds.
Well,
I've gone to so many meetings with young people that are just sober.
It's
the meat market.
Well, yeah. And Steve, to your point, I think that on the positive side of that, the more men I have met in recovery who are really doing the deal, you know, really, I mean, not to
toot either one of your horns like you need it, but really you and Jim and several others truly, I think, have grown emotionally as you have grown in sobriety. And you are not the typical man in addiction or in recovery. You know, and that's not to say that women don't have needs either, but
right.
I think that that's what scared me, was that I didn't know how to deal with those needs because it had always been under the influence. So how do I deal with those sober? What does that look like?
Right. I agree.
And he's only in for one thing, you know? Yeah.
But that's the one track mind that a lot of early young, especially younger males have in sobriety. It's like, I just want to, you know, and, you know, then that's that boundary that you hit, that invisible line where, you know, women are a little bit more mature maybe in early sobriety. I'll go so far as saying that.
I think Jim said on the last one that women are overall more mature.
You like to pick and choose what you remember, don't you? That's cute. Real cute. You know what? I'm a little disappointed.
I've got this Rain Man.
I'm a little disappointed because I don't know why. I thought you were married when you got sober. So I think we're missing a perspective of somebody that, you know, gets sober while they're already in a relationship. I don't know why. I thought you were married when you got sober in that situation and that dynamic. So I was expecting to hear a different perspective.
No.
2 weeks, I guess, is still buried. I mean, you didn't get, you know, it wasn't addressed until finalized in any way, right? You weren't handed paperwork until after you were sober 2 weeks.
Well, no, and the reason that it was filed is because I chose not to go away to rehab. So that's a whole nother topic, and that could go in my Oprah Winfrey show file. So
yeah,
I'll save that one.
Imagine it must be odd. Just, like I'm sure some of our listeners are listening right now, and they, you know, they got sober and they were married. They had a significant other that maybe these people still drank, and so. I really wonder. I wonder what it was like to be sober and going through these things, and still having a spouse that, you know, is still running their life the same way they've been. Whatever. I guess that's for a different show.
I want to know. I'm wondering, and I'm sure it'll come. How many guys in early sobriety are going to message me on Instagram and say thanks a lot, asshole?
Yeah.
And then just now block me or something like that.
Right?
Really great.
I mean, come on. I'm just gonna shut up.
You let the cat out of the bag. What the hell's wrong with you?
Now they know what we want. Oh,
like yeah, they didn't already fucking know. Come on.
Yeah, come on now.
We're still a guy.
It's not hard.
You know, it's so funny because people are like, oh, Jim, would you ever have like, would you have sex with somebody on like on a date? I'm like, I'm still a fucking guy. Maybe you have this cute image of me, and I love it that I have this image of a nice guy, but I'm like, I'm still a dude. Like, come on, we're still a guy. And don't act like you women are much different. Come on.
We don't need to ask.
Can of worms.
Did you just say, oh boy, Steve?
Yes.
So I think overall, I think we can say that we've all done exactly what we say you shouldn't do.
Right.
Yeah. And so we're living testimonies. Yeah. None of them, listening. And none of it worked out. Yeah. Like those people we dated in early recovery, none of that worked out.
Nope.
Right.
Nope.
But I think it.
But we thought we could do it our own way, just like we thought we could drink and be successful.
So my vote is don't do it.
Well, and I think it brought us, again, for me, it brought me to a place of knowing what I really needed in life and was looking for, and that's
part of the experience, strength, and hope that we pass on to others, but then others don't listen, just like we didn't listen to others.
Right.
You know, your wants in sobriety change just like your wants in any normal, I guess, person's life. It's like... when I was early sobriety, I was like, I had the vigor of an 18-year-old. And as I progressed in sobriety and I started to get more mature, because I think you do stop maturing when you start alcoholically and addictively pursuing mood-altering substances. You stop maturing. So it's kind of like you're back to being whatever you, whatever age you started, really, your alcoholic behavior is when you stop maturing. You go back to that age when you get sober. So 10 years down the road, God bless, if you're still sober, or 5 years, you have matured that much, almost like as coming from an 18-year-old. But if you do it and you're like 50 because you've been drinking for 20 years or 30 years, you kind of mature a lot faster because now you're catching up to your right age, you know?
Sure. Dana, how long have you been sober?
Going on 3.5 years.
Okay. Yeah. And Steve, how long?
13.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Good job. I'm the baby here by far.
Jim will have 22 months on Saturday.
How do you know that?
Because we had this, I had this conversation with someone who bought Valor stuff recently.
Listen, if you have a day,
right,
you're winning. A fucking day. Because sometimes I wake up and I'm like, I feel like shit, and I have trouble grasping the gratitude that I know is in there somewhere. And sometimes I just don't, I can't get it, you know, and I'll, sometimes it's just like, I know I'm sober, but I don't feel it, you know, and sober just doesn't mean to me not drinking, not drugging. It means the whole, it's all encompassing. Like, have I prayed? Like, do I even have faith in God anymore? And I go through these little mini battles in my head sometimes that last 18 seconds on a daily basis.
I was a dry drunk multiple times. I mean, I'm telling you, first time I've relapsed 8 or 9 times, and I think each time, you know, I would get back to 6 months sober, I would get back to 3 months, but each time I knew I wasn't done, and I didn't work a program. I had maybe had 6 months under my belt, but I wasn't working any kind of program. So in the back of my mind, I knew my last run had to come. So like what you say, like you can be you can technically not put that bottle in your mouth for a couple months, but if you're not working a program, you're just, it's just a matter of time.
No, and I feel sometimes like it's like day one, I'm just a miserable sack of shit, to be honest. And I really just like look in the mirror and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, am I asking to go backwards? You know, I've had that before where I've had tough times in life, and I've talked to family members, and my father has actually said, like, you know, I fear you're going backwards. And it happens because sometimes you forget what you're here for. You forget your purpose, and you forget why you got sober in the first place. And no, you don't have to pick up a drink, but you know what? You could be faltering, like, on every level. Every part of your personality could be regressing back into that darkness, you know? It's like, it sucks because sometimes you feel like, how did I get this far, you know, in sobriety? And then you're like, oh, wait, that's right. It's a 24-hour process. It's a daily reprieve. And there is no, like, oh, you get your button that says, like, congratulations, you got, you know, even though you get a coin, sometimes that coin, you feel it, you look at it, you're like, I don't feel this. I don't feel this 10 on here, or I don't feel this 12 on here, because I'm not full of 12 years of straight gratitude. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you remember life is a daily, 24-hour daily basis. You know, you gotta, sometimes you're living for the moment, you know?
I had someone ask me recently why I thought I would never be recovered. And if I felt like I would never be recovered, why do I feel like there's any hope? And what I said was that I try to be, I look at it as a continual work in progress. And those days when I'm feeling off, I know exactly what I need to do. That doesn't mean I'm going to do it right away. Sometimes sitting in that shit is really what I need for the moment. But knowing the sec, you know, it seems like it never fails me. I'll be in that headspace, and then someone will shoot me a text or send me a message or something and say, hey, do you have a minute? I'm wondering if we can talk. I'm like, no, I don't want to have a minute. Can I have a minute? You know, can I sit in that? But I know that that's not what I need. And so I think for me, knowing that, I don't know, knowing that I'm just going to always be a continual work in progress is something that does give me hope. I want to always grow and learn I'm never gonna get this. The moment that I think I've got this, it definitely has me. I can't think that way.
Sometimes my negative headspace has me question whether I'll ever get out of it. Sometimes I go so deep in it that I get scared that, is this what it's like? Is this permanent? Mm-hmm. Like, am I just going to be down in the dumps, you know? And sometimes I get so low that I get scared. I honestly do. And I don't know if that's just, I think that's, everyone gets like that at a certain point, maybe in their life. Hopefully that's what I'm chalking it up to.
What gets you out of that, Steve?
Honestly, sometimes going on Instagram, seeing one of you guys post, like seeing you do a video, or seeing Jim in that LA sunlight, you know, with a bunch of other athletes, like, you know, just posing normally for a picture. And I'm like, you know, I got friends that are just good, great people, not good people, you know, that I surround myself with. And what am I doing? Like, am I living what I say I'm living? Or how does that work? Do I say it first and then live it? Or do I live it and then say it? You know, it's, you know, like, why don't you just try and be grateful instead of being such a miserable, you know, asshole? And sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm still here, and that's what matters, you know? So you got to keep on looking at it like that. You're still living on the right side of dirt.
Right.
And that's sometimes enough for me.
Say, if I could just say one thing that kind of struck a chord with me when you just mentioned right now, you know, just being, and it's something that my sponsor really kind of opened my eyes up to, is just kind of being able to sit in it, basically, in whatever you're feeling, and however you feel, you best deal with it. Because I used to beat myself up constantly if I was having a bad day. Maybe I just needed to, like, you know, lay in bed for maybe an hour or two or longer, or however, you know, but, you know, just give myself a break, because I am human at the end of the day. You know, that I have feelings, and I'm going to need to walk through them and process them the best way that I can. You know, I truly believe, you know, I have a higher power, and, you know, I really feel that, not to get all spiritual or whatever, but, you know, my higher power's mercies are new every morning. And, you know, I may need to sit in it for the whole day, but usually I get up in the morning and, you know, it's all right. Let's do this thing. Let's get it started, because today's a new day, and you had your little timeout yesterday. So,
yeah, I had a woman who would always say to me, you are welcome to feel not okay. That's fine.
Right.
You cannot ever park yourself there. And if you feel yourself there for longer than 24 hours, you need to reach out for help.
Right. Right.
And anytime I would, especially in my first couple years of sobriety, you know, I mean, I've shared all of that. It was probably the first 3 years of sobriety was probably the hardest really of my life. I went through just a lot of life stuff. And so I was asking Steve, you know, what gets you out of that space? And for me, remembering those early days and thinking, okay, I got through those things and a drink never even crossed my mind. So I can get up and function and do okay today.
Right.
And what he also taught me that has really served me well is that when I reach out and say, you know what, I'm not okay, when I allow people to be of service to me, I'm letting them do their part of recovery. I'm letting them be of service how I need them to be, instead of sitting in it. So I don't know. That's been helpful.
Amen to that. Yeah. That isn't going to happen. You know, the tools, your tools, I mean, granted, we put all this time into it to develop these tools to pull us out, but they don't always work. And that's why bad days are there. It's like, you know, you don't have to, like what you both just said, I've said that multiple times. Sometimes just sit back and just fucking go grab a tub of ice cream, get the fucking remote control, lay in your bedroom for a day. Like, that's not the worst thing. Like, you know what? Like, your tools are not always going to work. And that's for people in new, and even in new recovery, they're like, oh man, I'm reaching out because I'm really struggling. I'm really struggling. Sometimes just feel it, man. Sometimes I do that often. Like, if I'm just having a shit day sometimes, and I'm like, okay, did I journal today? Yes. Did I work out? Did I do boom, boom? Have I dotted all? Have I checked all the boxes I have? Okay, yeah. So, you know, it's just a fuck day. I'm going to go get some fucking peanut M&M, some ice cream, and we're going to watch Netflix today, and I'm just going to just feel it, and I'm going to remember it. As long as you don't string too many back-to-back together, you know, as long as you don't string too many back, like, it's just going to happen. And I think what you said, like, I'll do it, but you know what? I'm blessed. Like, really, alcohol doesn't really ever cross my mind. Because, fuck, I know where that's taking me. You know?
Jim, what you just said, though, about checking and making sure everything, you know, going through your checklist or however you just said that, I think that is so critical, because it that takes me to the thought of this too shall pass. And yes, this too will pass, but that doesn't mean you don't have to do your part. And that doesn't mean you don't reach out and ask for help and try to do everything you can. And even if you've tried everything you can and it's still not working, okay, great, let's just take the day off today. But sometimes I think, especially what I've witnessed with early sponsees and early recovery, they'll say, well, you know, someone told me this too shall pass. I'll be okay. Right. But that doesn't mean you get a free pass. You still need to do your work.
You know, I went years in sobriety, trying to always be happy and always be in a good mood. And I had somebody who had a lot more time than I did say, that's not really healthy. And I looked at him like he had like two heads. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, the object isn't to avoid emotions and feelings that aren't happy. It's to be able to sit through them and deal with them without altering our moods with substances like alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're telling me that, yeah, we can't sit in bed in our shit too long, but we have to face it at some point and actually let it like touch us in some way so we can deal with things. And it took me like a little while to kind of get that through my thick head that, you know, you can't always look at everything with rose-colored glasses, especially in sobriety, because then it can come back and bite you in the ass if, you know, you're always constantly living in, you know, in this happy mood. Not to say that you shouldn't be in a good mood, to, you know, not to say like be in a bad mood or try and feel sad once in a while, but try and actually, instead of it's almost like a coping mechanism, saying everything's okay, you're gonna have to deal with like the negative side of life without drinking. And that's what sobriety is all about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what won't
So we have,
you know, what won't help it is cannabis, and that's a topic I want to talk about, cannabis and recovery, because I know I live in LA, so I know a couple of recovery centers that, you know, supposedly are curing addiction but using cannabis as a term, and that's popping up more and more. I want to dig into this one, man. I think
that's what I wanted to bring up next. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we want to get into this next topic, and that is what we call the marijuana maintenance over here in the Northeast. I don't know what you guys call it over there, but basically it's saying, you know, it's like you're not sober. Some people think you are. I don't know any of these people, but I've heard of it. And some people that are against it say, you know, I can't change your mind about your sobriety, but if you're going to do it, good luck with that. Basically, it's like, let me know how it turns out, you know, in other words. And I don't, from my personal perspective, I don't know how you guys feel, I don't think it's sobriety. I don't think smoking weed's anything to do with sobriety. You know, and it might not be a gateway drug to everything else. It might not open you up to start drinking again or start shooting dope or doing blow or whatever. But it's I look at it as a drug, you know. People say, well, it's natural, you know, it grows in God's earth. Okay, but
so do potatoes that vodka's made out of.
Yeah.
Jim, so, what's your
you know what? I have a fairly strong point of view, but I also at the same time know my mind has been changed so many times, like through experiences, through science. You know, science will go change things. I am definitely not for it at all, wasn't any way, shape, or form. I know most of the people that I come in contact with that are very young, and they're for it. And I know alcohol wasn't a problem for me for a long time also, and they say, you know what, you know, marijuana is not a problem for me, I can handle it. Guess what? I thought I could handle alcohol too, because I was fucking homeless and I couldn't, as a 40-year-old man. Most of the people that I think are advocates for it are the younger people, and they just, maybe they maybe they just haven't learned. Maybe they're smarter than me. They know something that I don't. Maybe they just haven't experienced it. But with me, you know, I know that we have all, I don't like to get strong opinionated on one thing or another, because I have had my mind change. And I knew in early sobriety, I learned that if you just shut up, if you have an opinion of something and you just be quiet for a second, maybe you might realize why that is. But the millions and millions of people in AA that are much older than me, that have been where I have and are way past where I am, say, you know, you got to just stop it. And then I don't know anybody really that's an elder statesman that still swears by marijuana that wasn't an addict. You know, just to be clear, we're talking about cannabis specifically in addiction recovery, not just cannabis therapy, people that don't have like an alcohol problem or a cocaine problem. We're talking about straight people from recovery have had lost everything, have true alcoholics, true cocaine addicts, etc. But, you know, I think it's the most ridiculous thing ever. And, you know, when people come to me, I'm in LA, so there's lots of facilities and marijuana is everywhere. People that come to me, they usually are going out of their way to try to explain themselves. And I'm like, if you really have to go out of your way to try to explain something and to validate your opinion, that's your first sign that maybe something's wrong there. If maybe you already know, you're just trying to talk yourself into it. Like, is that what's going on?
Yeah.
I don't know anyone that's been successful, but then again, I don't go asking people. You know, for me, this alcoholic, I should say, I'm against
it. Yeah, I think, and thanks both of you for sharing. I think my perspective on it is much the same, I think, for a number of reasons. But I do believe that if you are, and I'm not going to say if I am, because this is not a program that I would ever endorse, but if you are thinking that that is sobriety, or if you are thinking that it's going to keep you clean, I know for this alcoholic talking, I did not make the best choices while I was under the influence of any mind-altering drug, anything. So if I was under some cannabis maintenance program, I have a feeling that I might head down that slippery slope back into where I was. I don't want to tempt that I have another recovery in me. It's not worth it. I've worked too hard for 5.5 years to test that theory. And I think my biggest beef with this comes when I hear people say, I've been sober, I'm clean and sober for 700 days, but I smoke pot or I am on marijuana maintenance. Well, I think that's tainting the powerfulness of what sobriety is. And for me, and knowing how hard I have worked in sobriety, I feel like it's weakening the work I've done personally.
Well, I almost commented on someone's post that said that the other day, and I just restrained a pen and tongue. I just said, it's not your place. But I really wanted to say something, because I can't be everyone's sponsor, and I've gotten involved before, you know. But I had to back off this situation because it was just going to go bad. Because I was a Twitter person for a little while, and I know what it's like when you get in these online social media, you know, scrums as they call it. You know, it's like I was going to say, listen, you're not sober. You know, get your head out of your ass. But I know it was started something, and that's part of my recovery. You know, realizing where it's my place to step in. But if you ask my opinion, it's something else. It just be addicted. It's mind.
Well, and I think for me that's the point of it, is that I have to work only my program. But if I am helping other sponsees and they are asking my advice, and I'm trying to lead them down a path of sobriety that they're asking for help on, that is not sobriety to me. And that is my opinion. I can't tell someone else what to do, but I don't know. I have such a hard time when I see something like that, and then it's marijuana maintenance or like, I don't know, something like it. That is a clean moment to me.
Yeah, if it, like, let's put it this way, you always go by if a sponsor asked you. You know, if a sponsor asked you if they should do it or don't do it, and if you consider it sobriety or not, my answer would be no.
I'm on the same page as you guys. I mean, I definitely wholeheartedly agree that, you know, if you're taking anything that's allowing you to get out, you know, get outside of yourself, then you're not.
I only do coke to stay up. You know, it's a necessity. I got to work late hours.
I hate that I want to slap these people upside the head, but I kind of do. Like, but I really want to slap them upside the head sometimes. Like, how are you? Have you allowed yourself? Your life has gotten destroyed by, say, alcohol or meth or whatever, and you have pulled yourself from the depths of that. Now trying to justify something else. Like, shut the fuck up. I got in the once again. I maybe my opinion might get changed down the road, but this one guy. Oh my God, he was just out of his mind. I was talking to this gentleman about it, and it was actually. I'm not going to get into it. So he was like, hey, do you take a pre-workout? And I was like, yeah, I take pre-workouts. He's like, what's the difference between marijuana and pre-workout? Pre-workouts alter your... I was like, are you really trying to use that as a comparison? Like, if you're stretching that far, then, like, I don't even want to have this conversation with you anymore because we're at such... You know, which brings me to another topic. You really have to evaluate who you're, you know, having the conversation with. And if you're like-minded, you know, what... You know, yeah. You know, if you guys are really on the same level in any thought process whatsoever... Not saying you're better or below them, because you're not. Like, my opinions have been changed before, and what I thought was really strong opinion about something at one point may have changed, you know, for whatever reason. Like, I remember when COVID first started, they were like, oh, it's in the air for 3 hours, you know, and then that changed. So, you know, things change. So, but, well, like, if you're in addiction recovery, alcohol recovery, you've lost and had alcohol or something destroy your life, and now you're going to try something that can easily has been described by millions of people as a gateway, like any drugs that's gateway. Like when I was in recovery, I was told ABC, you know, lots of the place where I got sober with, most of the people were for crystal meth. If ABC means alcohol becomes crystal, because lots of people, and you know, oh, I don't do crystal anymore, I can drink alcohol now. No, that's just a gateway drug. It's your mind. Your mind's going to go places. If why even do that? Like, I don't even get it. Whatever. I'm going to shut up.
Yeah, I think that's exactly my point too, Jim. It's not worth it. And like Dana just said, why would you, anything that you're using to numb away feelings, that's what I did when I was drinking. Why the hell would I want to try that again? Yeah.
When I started drinking, I mean, you're talking about meth. Like the first thing I did after like I hit like beer number three or glass of whatever number three was I started thinking of just shoving shit up my nose, you know. And it's like, yeah, I think that with marijuana I actually relapsed because of that. Because when I went to my first rehab when I was like 20, 21 for coke, well, as I thought was coke, but I was just trying to dry out a little bit or whatever you call it off that, because I was addicted to everything. It's my personality. I started the marijuana maintenance, you know, smoking about 3 months after, and I was drinking within a month, and then it was like off to the races. So no, it's not going to work for me anyway. And I think it's just watering down the whole sobriety thing. That's where maybe I get on my high horse and I'm like, well, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, because you're obviously getting stoned and, you know, thinking that it's working for you. But then there's that other problem that comes in, you know, with the medical marijuana. You know, if you have anxiety and you're an alcoholic and a drug addict and somebody prescribes it for you, then it's like, now it's like we're not, you know, we're not doctors, and it becomes fuzzy. So, you know, that's the only, I guess, the only.
What's your thought on that, Jim?
Being prescribed? I used alcohol. Used alcohol to take away my anxiety for a long time too. You know, I definitely, I fucking.
For sure.
You know, you know, it wasn't easy. Definitely, it's not easy to stop drinking. So, anxiety is. Well, we've learned, you know, the four of us have experienced this. Like, your anxiety didn't go away overnight, but it went away. And, you know, you had to just abstain from alcohol. Like, it's never, if you now just replace that with marijuana, maybe marijuana will be good for a little bit, but like, really, like, when's it going to stop working? When's it all of a sudden going to be, you know, the issue that alcohol was then for what? You before, where all of a sudden you're fucking homeless, you're fucking scraping the street to fucking the whatever, and you have no friends and nothing, no money, no job. Like,
well, and then what after oh, that doesn't work anymore? Oh,
yeah,
what?
Now it's just, it's, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing when people think they can still drink. They're like, oh, I only had one drink this month. I'm like, all right, maybe you're fine.
I'm probably, I'm probably like the first of all, I'm the least advocate. I think I've smoked marijuana maybe 15 times in my whole life. That was never my thing. I've never smoked cigarettes. I've never had a cigarette in my life.
Oh,
never. My mom used to hotbox me when I was a kid, man. I fucking hated that shit. I couldn't stand. I used to break her cigarettes and flush them in the toilet, and she would get so mad at me. But I've literally never had a cigarette, and I've never been a fan of marijuana, and I've never hung out with people that were, the people I hung out with, we just straight just drank. We didn't, that.
I did a lot. I smoked a lot of pot. Let's put it that way. To put it lightly, it was like an all day affair for like 10 years straight, probably. Like, day in. I don't remember a time where I wasn't stoned.
I think this is probably one of the most interesting pieces to me of recovery is that truly the four of us have completely different stories, completely different ways we got here. And yet, here we are on a Thursday night trying to live and share in the solution. And I think I've smoked pot one time and twice in my life, and I, you know, when we moved here, everyone was like, "Oh, you're moving."
I was going to say,
Colorado, right? Like, or the mountains, you know.
Just going to say,
yeah.
That's exactly why we moved, right? It's why everyone from California,
yeah, Rocky
moved,
Mountain High.
Know? But I think it's just interesting when you think, you know, I asked someone what they wanted to hear for a topic on getting some ideas for this, and they talked about the addict brain and what does that look like, and how do you feel, what he specifically asked me was, how do you feel like your brain has changed in sobriety? And, you know, we touched on that a little bit with emotions and all of that, but I think in terms of the addict brain, all four of us are so different. And yet, yes, here we are able to talk on the common solution. That's one of my favorite parts of the program.
Yeah, for sure.
Because all roads lead to the same, all these paths that we're on, they all lead to the same.
If you choose it.
Give up your will. Yeah.
And it's so funny because I've explained this to Steve, like, you know, he just described it earlier. You know, I know that he started, how young were you when you started using or drinking or whatever?
I was drinking at 12, I was doing coke at 15, so.
I actually never drank until the day I turned 21, and I was always perceived in high school as like a goody two-shoes. I was very athletic. I was very athletic. I had a great core group of girlfriends. We were all like really kind of that, I'm a quote unquote type of girl that just didn't go to parties. We didn't, you know, we were fairly known, but we just didn't do that kind of stuff. And like I said, not until the day I turned 21, but you know, and initially it became a social thing, and you know, and then just, you know, I remember in my home group, someone, and I'm sure this is widely used, but you know, somebody said, you know, alcohol was, you know, was fun, that became fun with problems, and then just being problems, and that's exactly how it played out for me, you know, for the better part of 20 years. So,
well, and Dana, I think you just touched on something that we will have to talk about on a different night, but the fierceness and the rapidness that comes with women in active addiction, because my story is pretty similar to yours, and
okay.
I didn't need to drink and use anything for 25 years in order to completely have my life fall apart.
Right. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. How long have you guys been dating? You're not getting away with answering that. I mean, come on.
What happened?
I'm shocked that waited this long.
Well, in me too. In all fairness, Steve and I actually have been talking for like almost a year. From a distance on Instagram.
From a distance.
There's our music. And then,
speaking of.
There's our music. Yes. I had Let's Get It On as our playlist, but we can do From a Distance.
You know, the platform that I'm working with only has those, like, you know.
Let's just
like
go with nothing then.
Just throw in. I don't have a lot to work with.
Yeah, remember the last time I interluded, like, with let's not play the same crap, and then you played the same crap. Yes!
Did I? All right, so.
This is now the third time you've told me that, and you know what? You're creating a habit. You're creating a habit, Steve. Let's just go no music.
It's going to be different this time.
I think now that,
right,
now that Dana is part of it.
No music?
Maybe Dana will have.
Yeah, you have control? Do you have control? Like DJ control over there, Dana? All right.
I do not, actually.
All right, I'll put something better, but there's only, like, Anchor only gives you.
Dana, I'm pretty sure you said you were an athlete back in the day, and I'm pretty sure I haven't mailed any Valor gear to you. So I'm just saying, you know, I don't know. I'll double check. Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe she needs some
Silver
AF stuff too.
Hey, I just started my Silver Beautiful line. We'll get you some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Nice. That for
Christmas. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now we're talking.
Get off, you know, I just did a photo shoot in New York 3 days ago, 2 days ago. Right,
I think
I just did a photo shoot. Valor just did a photo shoot in New York on Tuesday. Today's Thursday, technically. But we were at Battery Park right outside of, right on across the bay from the Statue of Liberty. And so we did it. I wasn't there because I couldn't go. I couldn't go because of quarantine. Like, you have to 14-day quarantine in New York. But I have photographer and models out there.
Right, okay.
I was going to say, dude, I was in Jersey City, which is like 3 miles away. I can see Battery Park. I was going to say, if you were there.
I want to go. I've never been to the East Coast, so I definitely want to go out there. But I wanted to get pictures right by the Statue of Liberty, but they didn't want to take the ferry. Like, time was running out, and, you know, it gets dark over there, like, fucking 4:30 now or something stupid, but whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets dark early, and, yeah.
Hey, this is a good show. We're hitting an hour. Yeah.
Go hang out in South Bronx. They'll love you up there. It's, like, 10 degrees out. You know, there's drug dealers in the corner.
God, you got to. You know, got to.
They got to do what they got to do. But good times. All right, folks, I'm going to wrap it up. We're past the hour, and you know what the saying is. I don't know. I'm asking you. But we had a great episode.
Oh, God.
I'm going
to
put some.
I'm going to apologize to everybody listening now.
Listen, this is going to be. I'm going to go ahead and say this is going to be. It was going to be a top-notch episode, all right?
I apologize for the Etsy and Pinterest comments earlier in the show. That's kind of like an in thing between me and Say. I kind of make fun of her sometimes, so.
No, he's not.
Oh, I didn't even hear that.
I didn't pick up on that. He's not apologizing.
Listen,
to me.
I was too
that's cute.
I'm fucking weird.
Wait, what'd you say?
I'm not even paying attention.
Well, I'm on Match.com right now trying to get a date. So if you guys, if we can end this, I would really appreciate it. I got them lined up.
Good luck with that, Jim. Yeah.
Now all the girls at Match.com are going to be like,
it's only 7:15 in LA right now. I can get 3 dates in tonight.
Oh, Jesus. All right. We'll end it that note.
Bye.
All right. Be good, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right.